Hi, this is Mike Shea of SlyFlourish.com and Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. I had a chance today to talk to Randall Walker. He is the co-host of the Dungeon Master Roundtable and the writer of Initiative or What, a blog dedicated to Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition and role-playing game, various role-playing game thoughts. He is a fan of Terrain, and today he and I talk about terrain effects, both in the effects of terrain inside of a battle. What are the mechanics of terrain? When would you want to use it? What are some tips for using it effectively? And also in the actual physical terrain that you would use at your table, various things like dungeon tiles, paper maps, Dwarven Forge, and other options for building creative and unique and interesting terrain for your players to enjoy. So this is a slightly longer than an hour, and I hope you enjoy it. So I thought we'd talk in two parts today about terrain and how people can use terrain in their game. Part one, I thought we would talk about the actual use of terrain in game. How terrain can change encounters, and how you can, how DMs can use terrain, what players think of terrain, and different ways to, do's and don'ts for how to use terrain inside combat. I think 4E, more so than other previous versions of D&D, kind of focuses on terrain as part of an encounter. You know, it's well outside of the 10x10 room that, like first and second edition kind of had. And
oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very dynamic part of the of the encounter. In fact, it becomes, I mean, if you consider, hazards, which are sort of terrain that will hurt you, then yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right, right. And then in part two, I thought we'd talk about actual physical terrain that we use at our game table.
Sweet.
The different kinds and where to get it, and how long it takes to set up for different types and stuff like that. Where the best bang for dollar and bang for time comes in setting up terrain for people.
Cool.
So in talking about in-game terrain, what are some of the things that you have noticed? How do you use terrain? What are some of the things that go through your mind when you're designing an encounter and when you're actually running one when it comes to terrain?
Well, I try to, when I'm designing an encounter, if terrain is going to be a feature, and I think it happens, I use terrain more often when I know the terrain is actually going to be a feature. In other words, terrain effects, if we want to clarify that, as far as physical terrain being, the props, and then the terrain effect as being an in-game effect.
Sure.
Your normal inn and things like that, terrain effects, you're probably not going to have a lot. But like, for example, one of the big ones I did was actually having a moving train, and so the train itself moved. Right. You're on a platform that's constantly
moving. The whole thing is terrain.
Exactly. And so, if you want for the characters to get from one place to another, particularly if they had to do it creatively, like if there was a big monster blocking the way or something like that, they would have to jump from car to car.
Right.
And you've got a train car moving at, fantasy speeds, 20 miles an hour. But nevertheless, you fall off, that's going to hurt.
Sure.
So, but the train itself becomes a feature of the, a standard feature of the encounter. Mm-hmm. I've had situations where they've been on slopes of mountains, mm-hmm. where you don't have a horizontal terrain. Mm-hmm. And so, there's the terrain will at times slip and literally pull you down a vertical distance and have a chance of slipping and falling like that. So those are a couple of examples right off the top of my head that I've used.
Yeah. I use the whole map as a big piece of terrain or a big terrain effect in the I guess it was in Epic Tier when my group was in Sigil and they were in the process of stealing a chaos ship. There was some chaos ships that Orcus's right-hand guy, the Ghoul King.
Oh, right.
Dora saying the Ghoul King had hired, and the party stole one of them. And the gal who captained the ship was a telekinetic Githyanki. and her, you know, she could control the entire physical ship with her mind.
Oh, wow.
So throughout the battle, she would, like, you know, as a minor action, she could tilt the ship one way or the other, and everyone would slide for and could potentially fall off the edge of the ship into the chaos, you know, the seas of chaos. And on top of, you know, she had a lot of neat abilities where she could, like, pull people close and then slice them with a sword and, you know, throw them around. But then she could also do this whole move the whole ship around, and that kind of freaked everybody out. And the great thing is then they tied her up to interrogate her.
Oh.
And she's a telekinetic. You know, what you do with her arms doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. But, it's like that's not going to help much. Yeah,
she kind of, you know, she kind of made it clear, like, you're not really going to get very far with the intimidate check with me, but diplomacy works. And they eventually convinced her to captain the ship for them. So she became kind of an NPC that worked for them after that, which was pretty much every villain they fought throughout the entire campaign ended up working for them in one sense or another. So, except for Orcus. He never worked for them.
Well, I know one of the future things that I want to do in a campaign that I'm working with now, or will soon be jumping in. I've been using a lot of prepared material lately, so there's not a lot of terrain effects in some of the introductory. I mean, my party is still in heroic. We meet once a month, so we don't get an opportunity to play a whole lot. But the campaign that will be coming up is going to be based on the Myst series of video games. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with that at all, there are a number of places where there are mobile machines.
Right.
That has a very steampunkish type feel.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be one where they will actually be in a moving, if you will, sort of like a mine cart. Uh-huh. And they will have to know, based on sound, which direction to turn the mine cart. And if they go into a dead end, a terrain effect occurs at that end. So some damage. Like a, you know, falling lava or something like that, to that effect. So, but they will have to feel, literally based on a sound that I give them, they'll have to know which way to turn the car to get through the maze. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember Myst that well, but that was like one of the sections of, and I'm trying to remember which world part it was, but, well, I can't remember that off the top of my head. But anyway.
Yeah, I got those, like the third, like, part where you had to pull three levers in a certain sequence, and that was done. So, never got very far and missed.
I've always loved it. I thought I think the world is really rich, and it's got a lot of background and history and stuff to it. And so I think it makes it interesting for a D&D campaign. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is insert monsters, because there's no monsters in Myst. Right. So you kind of have to make that part of. But that's a great opportunity, though, to be able to do things that maybe the original game didn't have. So But moving terrain, I like that. I like it a lot. I would actually at some point like to come up with some kind of tram that actually moved on the table.
Mm.
Either use train track or something like that that would actually physically move the terrain around the table. That's I just think it'd idea. Be yeah. So sorry, kind of broaching that physical realm
no,
there.
That's
but
okay.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you know, that's a little tricky. I mean, you know, in encounter design, I think one of the things I do, I have like a checklist that I follow whenever I design encounters, which, you know, is good and bad because sometimes it can get in the way of creativity, but it means that I'm always kind of thinking about, well, what are all the things that I need to have? And terrain is always one piece. Like, I always like to have one or two things that matter in a battle.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there are times where, you know, nothing matters. But one of the things that I notice I do a lot is I will use terrain as kind of a free way for me to tune an encounter without increasing the experience budget at all. You know, that it's an easy way to kind of, you know, either ratchet up the difficulty if you want, or speed things up in, you know, in all directions, that, you know, both players and monsters have an easier time in a certain room. Slow things down, although I don't think we do a lot of that, or want to do a lot of that in 4E combat, by making it difficult for groups to kind of get to each other.
Oh yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
So you know, how do you use terrain to kind of balance an encounter, or how do you use terrain to tune an encounter at all?
Well, one of the things that I'll do if I have some kind of terrain effect that's going on in an encounter, I'll plan for a full class, if you will, or in other words, a full group of players.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm missing one or two, the terrain might drop out,
or maybe the
terrain becomes, instead of a terrain effect,
mm-hmm.
the terrain becomes noteworthy, but is not, has no real game effect.
Right.
So I can drop it out without affecting while, you know, that lowers the difficulty of the encounter a little bit. So, you know, if we are missing one or two players, the encounter still has the same heft, but it doesn't, it's not going to kill them necessarily, you know, or just be too overbalanced that way.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with killing your players off.
Yeah.
Assuming a reasonably balanced encounter.
You don't wanna, you don't want to go crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't want to go crazy. You know, if you've got random trap doors opening up to pools of lava and stuff that are like insta death, you know, right. maybe you want to hold off on those if you're missing several people.
For, save that for fourth core.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So, but yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thinking I'm having in the top of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, if I'm drawing designing terrain effects, there's a legitimate reason why they're there.
Sure.
Now that is more flexible the higher I think you go up, because there are some pretty fantastic environments that occur at higher Paragon and Epic tiers.
Right.
I mean, you talk about planar travel and all kinds of weird stuff out there.
You can do pretty much what you want.
You can, exactly. But I think at the heroic level and lower Paragon, you try to want to base it in some kind of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are other people that are going to just shudder when I say that. You know, it's like, it's not a simulation. Well,
right.
you know, yes, but, you know, I don't want to push the willing suspension of disbelief too much.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, anything can happen and it doesn't make the world begins to not make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so if, for example, there are trap doors, just a simple example, if there are trap doors, there's a reason those are there. Either they were prison cells at one point in the dungeon, or they are one of the classic examples I'm thinking of is Slave Pits of the Undercity. I don't know if you're familiar with the module, classic first edition module. It was a tournament module, but there's an area where these Aspis creatures, they're like insect drones kind of a thing, are taking prisoners. And the floor of the is actually a grid of narrow beams because the cells are below.
Right.
And so the players actually have to fight these Aspis drones, which have a high dexterity, and so they can stay balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And so the players have to, or the characters actually have to balance on these beams while they fight past these drones and not fall into the pits below.
Right.
And so, you know, that, but they make sense why they're there. They're captive pit. I mean, they're pits to keep captives in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about when I say that, you know, I want to, it should be, there should be a reason why it's there.
Right.
Not just random, you know.
Yeah. There's kind of two interesting points that you bring up, and both that I've thought about and both that I've used. One is in how to scale a battle up or down by tweaking the terrain effect on the fly, depending on like the number of players you have or any other difficulty. But like, you know, last night I had designed an encounter where they went into a crypt, and the previous night we had six players with two leaders that were both very effective. They were the two most tactical players who were playing both of the leaders. So there was like no damage happening. Like it was a lot of damage happening, but it was a lot of the healing happening.
Right.
So I said, okay, well, I got to tune in that a little bit because I want the next battle to be a bit of a challenge. So I had this crypt that had been defiled by, this is all Dark Sun. So they had a defiler that had defiled the whole thing, which meant that in the entire encounter, the overall theme was that you received half healing from healing effects.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that, and then, you know, have fewer monsters. So it's not, you know, it's not complete punishment. It's a tuning mechanic. But then we only had four players with one leader last night. And I said, that's just going to be too rough. If I want to have any monsters in this, I want to have, you know, one elite and two regular guys. If I can have any monsters in this, then, and they're already taking a lot of damage and there's only one healer, then I better get rid of that effect. So I just dump the effect and the battle ran fine without it.
Right.
So, but it was a nice thing that I could kind of turn on and off depending. And it also meant that I really use the experience budget anyway, but if people do use it, you know, if there are people out there who are particularly tied to using the experience budget system, then this is a kind of a DM optimization technique.
Well, yeah. And I think it works well too, because I think, I mean, for me, for example, I use the experience point budget, but I don't level my players by it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of flexible there.
So you use
I'll
it when
level
you're building
my
an encounter, but you don't use it to award them. Yeah,
exactly. And so you're right. It makes it an easy thing. For example, the slippery floor might be there if they're at full strength or whatever. But if they're getting pretty, particularly if it's an area that's not critical to the storyline, I don't necessarily. And hopefully my players won't hear this because they'll know I'm a big softy. But it's like, I don't necessarily want to, I want the risk there, but I don't want to necessarily TPK them just because of crappy rolls or whatever.
Sure.
So, you know, if they're fighting some monsters that are normally immune, who would normally be, like, maybe they fly or they float, so the floor is no effect for them. I might turn off that slippery floor. You know, it's maybe it's not slippery anymore. Or maybe the zones, or there are specific zones, or the monster spits out effect that creates zones.
Or maybe give them a skill check that lets them, you know, avoid
exactly. But something that would allow that to mitigate those circumstances, so that you're they're not getting this the pounding that you might get if you wanted if they were at full strength. So,
but yeah, you brought up that other that other interesting thing that I have a tendency of doing this, and it makes me feel like kind of an evil DM. I almost always put terrain effects that if there are negative effects that the monsters can avoid. You know, this isn't really a terrain effect, but I've had battles where there's all tight hallways, lots and lots of small tight hallways that are one square wide. And then they're being, you know, attacked by insubstantial people. You know, so they could just float right through the hallways without any problem at all. And they can zip from one hallway and beat on one guy, and then go to another hallway and beat on the other. Well, they have to run 12 squares to get around it.
Well, that's actually a pretty great idea.
Yeah, it was a neat fight. I did it, and we'll talk about it when we talk about Dwarven Forge. But it was I got a new Dwarven Forge set called the Narrow Passages set.
Oh, sure.
And I built this room that was just nothing but narrow passages. And they actually they only had to fight four or three guys in it. It was four players, so it's three enemies. They only had to fight three enemies in it, but it was a challenging fight. But what they liked about it was that the room was particularly, you know, it took a lot of work for them to move around the room, but it wasn't annoying.
Right. So. Well, I had a couple of I designed some traps and hazards about a year ago, and I put them out there on the website. And one of them was a room where the walls, each wall shifted, and much like your narrow spaces, each turn the walls would have a turn in combat, and they would each move. Now, if you got caught, your player happened to be standing between a wall and another hard place, they would take damage. But you throw a monster in there, then you've got. You never know. The terrain constantly shifts. So they have no idea how to plan ahead. You can't set up area of effects very well because you just don't know where that wall's going to – these multiple walls. And the walls are only like two squares. So they're like 1 by 2 squares. So they're each moving and the room's big. So you make the room like, oh, I don't know, a dozen squares. And then you put, oh, I don't know, maybe 12 walls in it. And then of various in different locations and randomly spread out. And you've got a pretty good maze that constantly shifts. They can see everything. It's not like a hidden maze, but it makes it tactically difficult to plan because you don't know where that wall's going to go next. So do
you find you have the tendency to do what I do where I put things in that affect the PCs but don't really affect the monsters or in cases can boost the monsters? Or are you pretty even-handed about making sure that if you put terrain in that the terrain is something that you know, it could be a benefit or a detriment to both sides.
Most of the time, it's the terrain is neutral. For me, at least in my worlds and things, very rarely are the actual owners or the actual builders of that location the ones that are currently inhabiting it. And so if there's something there, it's usually because it was built before and the current inhabitants don't know anything about it. So they're going to have the same problems with the terrain. Now, there may be occasions where I will have creatures which are by their nature immune to certain terrain effects. Like, for example, you said the insubstantial people, things that fly and stuff like that. But it's more of an accident of chance. I don't plan for that necessarily. So I try to... Between those two, I probably try to even it out a little bit more. I do like monsters that create terrain. I actually like I created some one of the special abilities of the Modron or the Quadron that I created on the, which is on the website. Once it's when it gets bloodied, it drops and forms like a barrier wall. And you know, so you've got this wall of blades that because they've got four swords, right? So, you know, like all around. But now it's a barrier because he's bloody. He's not moving anywhere, but he's now creating blocked terrain. And they will set themselves up in such a way that when they are bloodied, they drop, and then that creates a barrier against other things behind them. Like maybe a leader type Modron or something that's casting spells or whatever over the wall.
Right.
So the monsters that I, but I love monsters that do, I think a part of that comes from my 3 years of WoW experience that I had, mm-hmm. and seeing monsters do stuff when they died,
yeah.
or those kinds of things. And I like that. And plus the players hate it. Can't we just kill it?
Why does everything have to be weird?
Yeah. And I remember way back in the day, we're talking 84, I was playing Dragonlance, and every stupid draconian you killed, something crappy happened. One turns to acid, one freezes to stone, so your blade gets stuck. One explodes. Right. I mean, it's like, oh crap!
Everyone, you know? I want to kill him.
So, you know, and that's why I love the bloodied condition in 4E. I think it's a great mechanic
because you can trigger stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Trigger so many things with it and spawn minions. I mean, but terrain effects can be spawned. Like, you know, it spews oil and makes a spot that's slick or catches that area on fire or what have you. So, you know, I really love monsters with that can generate terrain effects. So
do you use terrain? And if so, how to try to keep your PCs moving around a map? And by that, I mean, like, how do you use like a carrot and a stick technique to say, like, sure, there's the areas where if you stand in there, you're going to take, you know, 10 necrotic damage because it's this, you know, pool of necrotic horror or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then there's the carrot, which is like, if you go and you stand over on this high point, you'll gain combat advantage against all your enemies. I mean, have you ever done anything like that to try to get players? Because, like, the problem is, like, PCs will often just stay right at the entrance to a room, right? They don't want to go
right.
in. And they're just like, I'm going to stand here at this doorway until I see what attacks me, and then I'll probably still stay in this doorway until I kill it. And you're like, yeah, but I have this nice big map, and I want you guys to go to the far corners of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what have you found with that?
One of the things that I've done most is to use elevation. Mm-hmm. And that's to and put your and use what's the word that 4E uses for like strikers? Artillery. Mm-hmm. I use artillery monsters so that they're firing from a distance.
Sure.
But their goal will be obvious and it's up on the terrain. And so if you don't cross that room and get up onto that high ground, you're going to constantly be taking, you know, pot shots, damage, whatever. And even if the room is fairly uninteresting, just that element, just adding an element of terrain right at the opposite end of the room where you've got snipers, and it makes it very effective to motivate the players over to get up there so that they're not, you know, constantly exposed to that weapon fire.
Right.
That's a big one that I've used most often when I've had that happen. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, I haven't used it a whole lot, so I don't have a whole lot of experience with it, but I know that it's also one of the effective techniques that the published adventures are using. Mm-hmm. So I see it a lot in those. A lot of them where they're on high ground and you got to get the players over to the high ground, or they're just going to continue to get hammered over and over again.
It probably still falls under the stick technique, right? That,
like, yeah.
You're going to get shot over and over again until you go over there and beat those dudes.
Exactly, right.
But every so often I'll have one where it's like, it's a pretty dark cavern and everything like that, but there's a magic crystal area, and if you are adjacent to the magic crystal when you perform an attack, you gain an extra 1d6 of radiant damage to your attack. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, ooh, I want to get over to those crystals. And that way they now have, you know, something other than, I want to get over there because it's painful if I don't, to, I want to get over there because there's an advantage if I do.
Oh, and that's an excellent idea. Yeah, that's fantastic. So.
Yeah, so it's just a nice kind of, you know, I mean, the overall goal is to, like, I want every battle to be very different from every other battle. You know, I don't want to run two battles that are kind of the same.
Right.
So, and using terrain to kind of push players out of one area and push them into another, not necessarily directly, but just, you know, giving options for them to go, it'd be more interesting if the party was spread out, or how do you get them to separate themselves when they know how bad an idea that is? But the goal is too great. You know, the advantages are too great.
Yeah, you have to wave a pretty good carrot sometimes. I have a pretty conservative group. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not so bad that every 5 feet they're checking for traps, but they're still a pretty conservative group. So you have to often, you know, wave a pretty big, like, a big hint in front of them. It's like, yeah, you should really try to exploit it. Would there be some risk? Well, yeah, probably, but I guess, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Right.
So.
I I guess in the Japanese subway systems, when it gets to rush hour, they have guys with these big plexiglass shields that will shove everybody into a...
I've heard of that, yeah.
They just mm-hmm. pack people into a subway. So I always want like one of those at the back of a dungeon. That's just every time the PCs yeah. get stuck, you just have these dudes with shields, you know, and you could like cheat, like, oh, well, you know, Roaring Flame starts to roll up behind you. And mm-hmm. if you don't get your ass into this room because I'm bored, then I'm going to yeah. burn you.
Langoliers are always
yeah,
effective.
Langoliers, right. Yeah, they're chewing up the world behind you.
That's so. Right. You better. That's yeah. Oh, wow. That's an actual great epic idea.
Yeah, exactly. Epic campaign. Right, right. You can have like a pocket dimension where the dimension is eating itself. And that, yeah, that, you could do that physically too, where you just start taking away parts of the tiles.
Wow, that's yeah. I think there we just go. Gave birth to something just, here, Mike. Just, that's awesome.
Now how do we sell it? We got to capitalize off that.
That's right. So, yeah.
So I have three like terrain do's and don'ts. You know, three specific things that I try to keep in mind when I'm designing terrain. Do you have a list like that of things that you try to keep in mind when you're building terrain?
I usually keep it pretty free form. I don't really, you know, I try to take it, I take a very holistic approach to it. Mm-hmm. I consider, you know, the ecology of the area. I consider, you know, the history of the area right. that I'm trying to build in, who's come before, what's likely to be in that location. Mm-hmm. And, I don't really have what I'd consider a checklist. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's just my whim, you know, it's like, oh, well, that sounds good. Well, does it fit? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it fits. Cool. We'll use that. So, right. you know, that's kind of how I work. Checklists, it's just not the kind of, and I probably could use them. I could probably benefit from them. Mm-hmm. But
sometimes
I
they can harness I, you too.
Yeah, they can. Right. I think in some cases you're probably right. But if you hit upon a great formula, then shoot, use your formula. Sure. I mean, shoot, sure. you know, it's whatever really works for you as a DM, I think. Yeah. And that's important. I think the regardless of whether you use a list or you just completely wing it by hand or free thought, the important thing is that you work and use what's working for you and your players. Mm-hmm. And if you're using a technique and your players are loving what you're doing, keep doing it. Yeah. I mean, that's the way to go with it. So
yeah, I mean, that kind of hits like the rule zero. You know, rule zero applies as much to terrain as it applies to everything else in the game, which is, you know, the terrain is essentially there to be fun for the players. So you have to ask yourself, okay, I'm putting this terrain in, and whether it hurts them or helps them, you know, is it still mm-hmm. considered fun? And I've played in a couple of different games where the terrain was really just hindering. You know, yeah. they're like, there wasn't a real it did it fit? I suppose. You know, it didn't, it wasn't completely outside of, you know, the realm of reality. But was it annoying as hell? Yeah. You know, yeah. did all it do was slow me for 12 rounds, you know, and I had to, you know, it took me 6 rounds to get from one, you know, point A to point B, and I'm a melee attacker.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I think on occasion, but like the doldrum, the slow, like, oh, God, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that gets into, you know, some my three rules. So my number one rule is a rule of fun. You know, the very first thing, I mean, I really like your idea that you have to ask yourself, and I do this very much with the encounters, and I do it a lot with the NPCs and with locations, which is what is it now? What did it used to be? And, you know, what's, you know, how is it going to work? And,
right.
you know, so I'll have like an arena. I had an arena where it had been completely overtaken by the zombie cactuses of Athos. And, you know, so, but it was originally an arena. So it had arena things in it.
Oh, cool.
You know, that it had a purpose. It was a big, there was a big capture of the flag arena where the flag was on top. Well, that's where the zombie cactus now was.
Okay.
You know? And so you have these kind of two layers, right? Layer one is that it used to be an arena. So what was that like? And then layer two is, well, now the zombie cactuses have taken over. So now what is it like? And that gives kind of a rich environment. They really like that. But rule one is, you know, or my first tip is, you know, that every, you know, every DM that's going to put in a terrain effect needs to say, is this terrain, am I adding this because it's going to be fun, you know, or is it going to be fun when I add it in, whether it's right. going to be difficult or whether it's going to be advantageous? Is it overall, is it going to be considered enjoyable?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Number two is keep it simple. One thing I've made mistakes in the past of having terrain effects that are too complicated. You know, that I think one of the worst kind are terrain effects that do any kind of immobilization or, you know, restraining. It seems easy. Mm-hmm. Like I'll have a tree that grabs people, you know, and they get near the tree, they're immobilized, you know, and what right. are they immobilized? Well, the end of their next turn. Yeah, but they're adjacent to it. So that means at the end of the next turn, they're immobilized again.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, wow, I just made a magnet they can never break away from. I've actually seen that in published adventures where they clearly didn't design their terrain effects right because
you
know, they could get stuck and they could never get back out.
Yeah, you should allow for it, you know, where you can at least shift out of the range of the effect after you make the save. After you make the save.
This one, another player or another PC had to pull you out or you couldn't get out. And it was just too arduous. But I saw a technique, and it's in one of the terrain powers in the creature catalog, the Dark Sun creature catalog, where it's an immobilization that immobilizes you or restrains you till the beginning of your next turn. So it prevents you from moving, getting any free movement, and it prevents you from, you know, you grant combat advantage or whatever. You can't move until it's your turn. And then when it's your turn, then you can break free.
Right.
So that's kind of a nice way to do that. But anyway, the main thing is to keep it simple. I don't like attack rolls on terrain effects. I like to just do straight damage, or if I'm going to do damage. And I don't like, just because there's enough attack rolls already going on and it's terrain, it's not anything, you know, it's not supposed to be something interesting. So if it's not interesting, it really shouldn't have a big part of the spotlight. Unless that is the main part of your thing, right? It's potential that if terrain could be the big part.
Well, yeah, if it's actually part of the balance of the encounter, then what I try to do is that if it's an effect that does hold the player, then I'll do static damage. Mm-hmm. But if it's a movement thing or something that strikes,
then you'll give it an attack roll.
Then I'll give it an attack
roll. Actually, the attack roll's not that's not as big a deal to me as damage rolls. I had terrain that had damage rolls and it was just like, oh god, you know, it's not a monster. And actually I think it was a trap that I did. I'm not a big fan of traps. I don't know that I'm using them right. But to me, like I would never replace a monster with a trap, because I would rather put the trap in as an environmental effect rather than put it in as a pseudo creature.
Right.
Just because a spiked door, you know, just isn't as interesting as a mimic.
Well, no, that's true. If it's part of the room, I mean, I've gone both ways. I mean, I did a whole series on nothing that, you know, I designed a bunch of traps. I did a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And, I think that if the trap is too easy to disarm or disable, you've wasted a bunch of effort.
Sure.
You know, you got this beautifully designed trap.
They get rid of it right away.
They get rid of it right away, and then you've sort of like nerfed the encounter, you know, or they've nerfed the encounter. And I realize that there should be some potential for that.
Sure.
But not just like killing a monster, you know. If they kill the boss, I mean, and players can do that. I mean, it's possible to crit a boss right away if he's out there in the open. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've suddenly nerfed the encounter because the boss is all gone. And half the time your minions are going, oh, crap, we're out of here anyway because the boss is dead. So, you know, so it can happen. But I think that, you know, given a trap that does enough damage, it can certainly be, it could be a big part of the encounter. And if it's deadly enough, it'll hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, and my third tip is to use terrain as both carrots and sticks. You know, it's easy to kind of put things in the way that make it hard for characters, but it's more interesting to also say, like, how do you put things in there that they clearly want to use, you know, like, or clearly gain a benefit from? Is there an area where they can stand? You know, not to another part of my game. I love talking about my game, apparently. And,
that's okay. It's where you draw examples. Yeah. I mean, hey.
So they were in the abyss. They were in Thanatos, the layer of the abyss that Orcus owns. So it's all full of undead. And there was one place where a Solar had been sacrificed. And it was a single giant pillar of radiant energy that had the advantage that if you stood next to it, you gained radiant power. And it helped repel some of the onslaught of undead. But the negative side was that it was like a beacon of holy light in the center of Thanatos, which meant every demon and every undead on the whole surface was running towards it. So, you know, but it was an interesting, and I had a very specific thing in mind, which is I wanted the players to be fighting on top of this mound while they're surrounded by undead. You know, there was a piece of artwork I saw, and I said, I want that artwork as a battle. And to do it meant, you know, giving some carrot and stick, like, okay, well, if you stand up there, you get this extra attack. And one guy like jumped down to go fight him on the surface and, you know, promptly got his ass kicked and then climbed back up again.
I'm doing better here.
Yeah, I was doing better when I was next to everybody else. Well, because the healers are up there and everybody else.
Well, exactly, yeah.
So, so using terrain both as a carrot and a stick to get PCs moving around is one of the things I try to do, just to try to get, you know, try to get people moving around. So it sounds like the kind of the four big tips are Just to recap real quickly, the four big tips are, you know, decide how terrain matters in the world. Like, why is it there?
Right.
What, or more, instead of even saying why it's there, better to say what would be here. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're in this particular area, what would be around here that might be an interesting component for a battle? And then, you know, is whatever I'm putting in there, am I doing it to make sure that the game is going to be more fun? Is this piece of terrain in itself particularly fun, you know, or challenge? Right. And fun could also be challenge. Keep it simple, you know, try not, you don't want it to make your battle more complicated. You also, I mean, I also tend to use it to make the battle faster. Mm-hmm. You know, terrain is a great way to kind of throw some threat on the players, but reduce the number of monsters so that you can have a faster battle that could still be exciting and interesting.
Yep,
and then,
exactly.
And then the fourth one was to use carrots and sticks, you know, use it as carrot and stick to get your PCs moving around. So why don't we talk a little bit about actual physical props and stuff like that?
Excellent.
What do you use regularly at your game? How do you build your battle maps?
Regularly, I use a combination of the tiles, the essentials tiles that have come out. Mm-hmm. I use a lot of
The Dungeon Tile Master Sets?
Dungeon Tile Master Sets, the Outdoor Terrain Set, the City Set.
Dungeon.
Right. And I use those, and I use a lot of Hearthstart stuff that I've built myself. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I read your site about it. I saw some of the Hearst stuff that you've done. I've never done Hearst, but I've seen some of it. It looks cool.
It's very cool. It's tedious. You have to enjoy casting, yeah, and you have to enjoy building the terrain.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem.
Last summer, and if you don't have time, it's really difficult to do. Right. There are some beautiful pieces. If you go out to Void Gamers, there's a website called Void Gamers, and those folks are all terrain builders. And those guys have built some stuff that just blow your mind.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. I don't have that kind of time, so I'm trying to build. I try to build some modular stuff, things that I can use over and over again.
Sure.
Last summer, I did acquire my first Dwarven Forge set.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, I love it. It's great.
So what ones do you have?
I actually have just the one set.
Room and Passage?
A Room and Passage set, yeah. Right. And with the mix of other stuff that I have, it seems to be working out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly like the floor squares, actually. Mm-hmm. Are really useful for platforms and all other kinds of things.
Yep.
I've been able to duplicate most of the rooms in the prepared adventures that I use, and I'm running Thunderspire Labyrinth now, and mm-hmm. the one previous to that, Shadowfell.
Yeah,
Keep on the Shadowfell, yeah. Right. And most of the encounter areas I've been able to duplicate with the combination of those materials pretty effectively.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it's not hard to do. But you got to have room, and you got to have shelf space.
Yeah, right.
Which, you know, I last summer I acquired a nice big set of shelves that I could, you know, like a, you know, storeroom type shelving.
Yep.
So I can put all my stuff out on there. And I think a lot of the things that I like too are the accessory stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually going to be one thing I brought up, that the more detailed sets, mm-hmm. there's an advantage to the generic stuff, right?
Right.
That because you can use it for so many different things. So Room and Passages is a great set because it can be underground passages. It can be crypts. It can be buildings. Sure. It can be castles. Mm-hmm. You can do, you know, it's probably the most universal set. The problem is if you use it a lot, then all your rooms start to look exactly like every other room you built.
Right.
So that's when you get into like the Wicked Edition set, mm-hmm. which has, you know, all these little, you know, pillars and raised platforms and stairwells and fire pits and other things that you can use to kind of, you know, add all these little details in there. So yeah, details are important.
Yeah, I think the only kind of terrain that I've actually shied away from is and some of it's so gorgeous, but it's the cardstock terrain.
Yeah, stand-up cardstock?
Yeah, stand-up cardstock. Worldworks Games, I think is what it is, mm-hmm. makes some beautiful art. And it's fantastic stuff. The problem is that it's cost prohibitive. And you think, well, cardstock, that's cheap. Ah.
How much is their stuff? I haven't even looked.
Well, I think you can get a PDF for like, you know, less than $10.
Oh, yeah, but you have to print it.
I mean, well, that's just it. You have to print it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's
it's like
the $4,000
an ounce.
Yeah, I don't want to slam those guys, but you know, and it's beautiful artwork. But unless you got, you know, a work printer or someplace right. that you can like steal from,
it's important, boss.
Exactly. That's
working
right.
I got working on the Johnson Report.
That's right.
Working late on the Johnson Report.
You're printing six,
why does
you know.
Look like a brick wall.
Yeah. Trust me, it's okay. It's part of the artwork for the presentation. Right. Yeah. Especially if you talk about inkjet. Not everyone has a color laser printer. I'm fortunate enough to own an inexpensive one, but a lot of people don't have that. I'd say most people probably don't have a color laser printer at home, and they have an inkjet, though.
Well, but
inkjet's
$120 a cartridge. Right?
Oh, yeah, and you could print out one of these sets and blow through your cartridges.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, because they're that rich. But they're beautiful. Don't get me wrong. Sure. I mean, I love them. Yeah. But that's kind of – I shy away from that only because of the cost. It's actually cheaper for me to get Dwarven Forge.
Wow.
Or to build my stuff out of Hearst, which is actually
heard,
the best.
I've
cost.
Never heard anybody say it was cheaper to buy Dwarven Forge.
It is. Well, I mean, if you compare those two,
if you were to build the same stuff,
right,
know, it's conceivable that you'd spend as much on ink, and it's all cardboard. You know, it's not nice resin.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It's not going to stand up. You know, your kid accidentally steps on it.
Sure.
The Dwarven Forge might survive. The cardstock obviously is not. Mm-hmm. So, quite frankly, I really wish there was an in-between alternative.
Yeah. So with the dungeon tiles that you use, how do you, mm-hmm. what do you have any tips for using dungeon tiles? What do you find to be in a pretty effective way? I had the dungeon, you know, Dungeons and Dragons dungeon tile master set dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
It has dungeon in it three times. So I've had that one for a while, and I just got the wilderness and the city sets.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been buying dungeon tiles as long as they've been putting them out. But,
yeah.
You know, it can be particular about how you use it. So what do you find? Do you just throw them out there in their pieces, or do you?
Well, actually, and this piece of advice actually comes from my wife, who's a player in my game.
Mm-hmm.
They would get frustrated about how long it was taking for setups.
Right.
And so my big piece of advice for when you're using any dungeon terrain, tiles or anything, wow, plan ahead.
Yep.
And what I do is I take gaming paper.
Yep.
I think you're familiar with that probably.
Yep.
And I will draw out the layout of the room on the gaming paper. And then I take my tiles,
mm-hmm.
and then lay them out sort of like on a tangram, you know. I put the pieces onto the map,
mm-hmm.
to see how they fit. Mm-hmm. And once I know I've got all my pieces that I need, I shuffle them all into a baggie.
For that room.
For that room.
Yeah.
And that way I have it. So that when it's time, and I try to start I will have a setup already on the table, mm-hmm. when the game starts,
but
this will be for stuff that they may go on to later on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're going to get maybe through at the most, and this is on a good day, four encounters, okay?
Right.
And that's
a really good day.
Usually it's three, and we play about 4 to 5 hours.
Sure.
With a little bit, when you throw role playing in there, if we get through two or three encounters, I'm happy. You know, mm-hmm. But that's how many you need to plan for. And so I take those tiles and I put them in a plastic baggie, and that way I have it, and the setup goes much, much faster. I also, mm-hmm. set out my monsters ahead of time too that I'm going to be putting on the board,
because
I use miniatures. If you're going to use 3D terrain,
might as well use
miniatures.
Get them while you can.
That's exactly right. Oh, yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, and that's something else that I just wrote an article about that recently, is that there's a lot of things you can use out there,
mm-hmm.
for miniatures,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, you don't even think about. I mean, I was at Chuck E. Cheese at a kid's birthday party. It's like across the street from my house, right? So we're at this Chuck E. Cheese at a friend's birthday party, and, you know, what are you going to do? You play some skee-ball, you get some tickets. So I say, well, what am I going to do with these tickets? So I went over to the tech counter, and they had these little plastic frogs.
Oh, yeah, I think I read your...
I think I posted it on Twitter or whatever, yeah. And it was like, these are perfect. And they're like exactly 1 inch, and they're like giant frogs, right? And so classic module, Village of Hamlet, giant frogs, got to have giant frogs.
giant frogs.
So, you know, four giant frogs, boom, and they were like 10 or 5 tickets a piece or whatever. So
that's
sold,
awesome.
Done, you know. So, and you got a set of miniatures right there, boom. Dragons are easy to find. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can use for that kind of stuff. But going back to terrain, there's, you know, things like Dwarven Forge, and even building your own stuff out of Hearst stuff is great. But you don't have to do those kinds of things. You can find all kinds of stuff to make terrain with, and even if you're using cardboard boxes,
mm-hmm.
cut them down to scale.
Yep.
You know, grid them off, boom, you've got terrain. Mm-hmm. It's not, and it's a great afternoon craft project, mm-hmm. you know, if you're bored and, you know, get the family involved, whatever. But it's not anything that's insurmountable. I don't mind, and I have used for a lot of years, vinyl mats and other kinds of grid maps. Mm-hmm. Still use them from time to time to draw on with dry erase marker or whatever. Mm-hmm. And those are great, but it's 2D. Mm-hmm. And if you're whipping out a fast game or you're at a convention or something, that may be the best route to go with.
Right.
But if you're home and you're hosting the site, and if you're a DM that you're hosting in your own home, mm-hmm. there's no reason why you can't use some kind of 3D terrain.
Sure.
Even if it's just for your big boss fights at the end, because
right.
your players will always remember it.
Right, right.
And it's just, wow, remember that cool setup he had? Yeah, I remember that. That was awesome.
Yeah. So
my big bragging rights comes from the fact that I was able to do the first half of, the first third, excuse me, of Temple, why did my mind go blank?
Keep the show.
Tomb of Horrors.
Tomb of Horrors. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Actually built it out of Hearst.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. I had the traps. Yeah, that first
yeah,
big
I saw,
corridor.
There was somebody on the Dwarvenforge site that had built the entire dungeon in Dwarvenforge.
Saw that. Now, yeah. It'd be interesting to see how he did his traps. I actually fixed trap doors to the bottom. I had it elevated.
Oh, really? That's
fixed
that's pretty
trap
cool.
doors
yeah.
so I could pull them down
right.
if a player was. And I covered it with like a loose sand, sort of like you'd find in a tomb, so they couldn't see the dividing lines
wow.
on the traps.
Oh, wow.
So it was a, you know, they'd stop at a spot, and if I knew it was going to be a trap, yank. Now, this is during 3.5. This weren't 4.0 rules,
right.
but these 3.5 rules. But boom.
Nice.
And I had did secret doors. I did, you know, holes. And I covered, there's a big corridor, spoiler alert, but there's a big corridor in Tomb of Horrors where there's a big bunch of paintings, a lot of
right.
frescoes. And they all are holding these orbs
yeah.
or spheres. Well, and they're painted circles. Well, I had colored these different circles exactly as according to the module. And I had put the ones that hid secret passages. I did it like a fresco. I did a piece of paper and colored the paper and I put it over the stonework so that on the ones that were actual illusions, you could poke through the paper into the space beyond.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was pretty elaborate.
Yeah.
Oh, that whole setup probably took me well over a year to build.
Whoa.
And I only got a third of the way through.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I regret because I had a major, freaking World of Warcraft came along. And so like,
funny, I'm watching my wife reflected in my monitor playing World of Warcraft right now.
Yeah. I kind of lost 3 years of my life to that. But anyway.
I lost, you know, 5 years of my life to EverQuest, but I gained a wife from it. So
yeah, well, there you go. It probably came out even then.
The ultimate loot.
That's right. Exactly. Epic loot.
Epic loot.
So, but I regret not saving those pieces because things got broken and I got shuffled around and in the 3 years that we weren't playing really any D&D and so I didn't really and some of the designs weren't exactly like I wanted
mm-hmm.
and so I regret not taking a lot of pictures and doing stuff with that, but my intent one of these days maybe when I retire which is like 15 years away, you know, I can
yep.
dream
sure.
so I may go back to that because I think the kinds of molds that Bruce has produced for her starts are amazing
mm-hmm.
and they allow for a lot of flexibility
mm-hmm.
and you could build. I had plans in my head for almost every single one of the encounters in Tomb of Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
My dream would be to build it to scale
right.
and then like pack it up and ship it and display it at like Gen Con or
That'd
something.
Be pretty cool.
I think that would be awesome. And so now I just don't have time. There's so many other projects I got going on.
Sure.
And room. I don't have room to really build something like
right,
that at this
right.
point. But that's the dream. And I still play with the Hearst Arts because I'm working on another project. So,
right.
but
yeah. So the when you talk about dungeon tiles and the way you do dungeon tiles, there's a trick that I've been using for a number of years. You probably know it already. Which is using blue sticky tack and sticking the dungeons together on like a black piece of poster board.
And
that way you can have the whole room already built on a piece of cardboard that you can store sideways if you want to.
Yep.
You know, they'll all stick together, and then when it's time to go to that room, you just pull it out. And it's good for random encounters and things like that. If you got a room you're not sure if you're going to use it, you can pull it out.
How do you find that? I've I haven't used that a lot, only because I worry that it will pull off the.
Yeah, if you leave less than 24 hours from the time you put it on to the time you take it off, it's not going to be a problem. And just don't pull it real hard, you know, pull it lightly. I've had some where I left it for a long time. Like I had a game, I prepped it for the game on the weekend, then Wednesday rolled around and we couldn't play, so I just let it go another week. And then I would pull it off and there was like a tiny little tear. But, you know, people would have to look for it. And my general feeling, you know, I'm not real careful with my stuff. Even my Dwarven Forge, I'm not, you know, real careful. Cause I just figure, look, this stuff's going to get used. It's, you know, the world's falling apart anyway. So, you know, if my, you know, at whatever it is, $14 a box for dungeon tiles,
right.
You know, if it gets torn up over a period of a few years, I'll be okay. Like,
yeah,
I'll get it again or I'll get whatever they put out next.
Sure.
So the blue sticky tech really, I've only seen it damage like one or two tiles out of hundreds. And that was after I had left it for a long time because it gets kind of hard and it adheses. But the adhesive, and you use small amounts. You don't need much. You don't need big globs of it. You need just tiny little amounts that it's just enough because the cardboard's light. So
right,
it's just enough to hold that cardboard.
You know,
the cardboard on. So yeah, that to me like went from making Dwarven Forge useless to making it, you know, one of the best aids that I had for running good terrain.
Wow.
Just because it was so much more convenient that, you know, instead of having to build the map out multiple times, like, you know, I think when I first was using it, I guess Dungeon Tiles came out before 4E, if I recall.
Oh, yeah, they've been, yeah. I think 3.0 is when they first started.
I was using it for 3.5. And, I'd sit, like, on my, I'd get on the computer and I'd pull up, you know, whatever the mapper, you know, Wizards had a mapper app. I think there's somebody else that runs it now, but Pi Mapper.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it. Yeah.
So I ran some program like that and I would build it in that and then I'd print it out and then I'd get the tiles out and then I'd build it on my floor in my, you know, in my office downstairs and then I'd get that together and then I'd bag it up and then I'd take it upstairs and then when I'd play it, I'd have to put it back together again. I'm like, I'm building the map three times.
Right. Yeah.
I don't have time for that.
Exactly.
So, you know, I'm like, I could either build maps or I could make an awesome adventure. So,
right.
So instead it's, I realized that, wow, I could just dump the tiles out. I can build the map right on these black poster boards. And there's a little bit of an upfront cost because you got to buy. I have these like 11x14 boards, which is perfect for like one room. And then I have these large like 32 inch by 40 inch black boards. You know, they're just like foam board.
And, oh yeah, sure.
You know, that'll build like two or three rooms. You could build like an entire dungeon on one of those if you wanted. And then you can just lay them out, you know, as you need. So there's a little bit of upfront cost. It's like $5 for the smaller ones and like $10 to $15 for the bigger ones.
Yeah, but that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, but once you have them, you get to use them for years. Like I've had them and I think one of them bent and that's a problem, but I can always cut it and then use it as a smaller piece.
Well, sure.
So that really helped with dungeon tiles.
One of the things I'm thinking about experimenting with soon is I would like to be able to set up 3D terrains in advance and then store them on a shelf, whole actual 3D, not just the tiles,
right.
3D tray. And one of the things I'm thinking about doing that with is gardening trays. Mm-hmm. My wife uses these fairly long gardening trays for like, she actually uses it for felting, but they're these black trays and they're about an inch deep. Mm-hmm. And so there's a depth to them. Mm-hmm. But you could actually build your terrain in modular trays, store that on the shelf, and then just pull down the tray.
Are they
you
strong enough?
Yeah, it's a heavy duty vinyl like plastic. So it's, and I'm not talking about the real flimsy ones like you get at Walmart. These are actual. They got kind of a set of ridges on the bottom. These don't have drain holes, so there's other things that people may use them for. But they're.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. I just googled it.
All right.
Yeah, I see them here.
Yeah, and so they're. And they actually kind of they keep the terrain enclosed too, so you don't have. Now, you may still have to use your sticky tack that you're talking about to kind of keep it.
It depends. Like Dwarven Forge, you wouldn't, as long as you don't rattle it around.
Yeah, it's heavy enough that you probably wouldn't have to do that.
Right.
But it would keep it in a modular type format so that you can lift it and carry it, the whole setup, one shot, boom, set it down on the table. And if you time it, you could even probably cut the walls of it in such a way that if you have a corridor or something that leads to the next section,
oh, wow. you can put them together.
Right, sure, exactly. And so you now have a modular unit. Something I'm playing with, I haven't really done it a lot yet, but it was an idea I had the other day when I was trying to move something out of the way in the bathroom. It was like,
yeah. You know, I could use this for my Dungeons and Dragons game.
Exactly.
Everything's like that. Yeah. The some other people with dungeon tiles have used the sticky line of shelf liners. And
oh yeah,
they mm-hmm. like those a lot because you can put together an entire tile set and they won't move because it's tacky. So mm-hmm. And it doesn't stick, you know, it just holds it in place. And the only problem I have with that, I think I've never tried it, but the only thing that in my mind wouldn't work is I have a lot of stacked up pieces, like where you have like little flaming things that sit on top, and those would be right. floating. But it's still kind of a neat idea.
Yeah, I know. The only thing about sticky anything with glue makes me nervous because I'm worried that paint or the tile is going to get screwed up when it's down. But now if you had one sided tiles, that's not as big of a deal. But anymore, they're printing for usability, they print on both sides, and so it's kind of tough to do that. But I'd love to have one of the gaming tables that has like a glass top.
You
could just lay all your tiles down ahead of time, and you set the glass top on top of it. And
do you use paper maps at all? I mean, like pre-printed paper maps.
I do sometimes. The ones that have been included in the adventures I've been running, I'll use those when I've got them. Mm-hmm. Why not, right? I mean, it's free and it's right out there. And if there's anything that's 3D that I need to add to enhance that, I can set it right on the map.
Right.
And so it works out perfectly. And they're beautiful maps. I mean, they're fantastically drawn and stuff. So, on occasion I've used those before.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do a lot of designing with, Dungeenie.
Hmm.
Which was a mapping software that you can map to then scale, and it'll print to 1-inch scale. I picked it up. Dungeenie I started using back in 2004. Yeah, 2004, actually. It was a while back.
Hmm.
This product's been around for a while. But it does really nice maps. It's, it's not a tile map. What do they call it? No, it is a tile map. That's right, because you click on objects and you drop them onto the thing. Yeah, but I don't use that as much now because I've got enough 3D terrain that I can put together my maps and mm-hmm. I can envision in my head what I've got and what I can use. And if I don't have something, I'll build it.
Hmm.
I'll cast some blocks, and if I got some blocks, I'll just build the terrain.
That's cool.
So
I'm a big fan of this, the Paizo Game Mastery flip maps.
I've got three of those.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them now. I've been picking more and more of them up, and they're like 11 or 12 bucks. They're pretty mm-hmm. cheap, and they're laminated, so they're stronger than the paper maps. And they're dry erase or wet erase, mm-hmm. so you can draw on top of them on as well. And they whoever does their cartography, it's really good. I have the boats and the arena and the forest and some underground caverns that I've used a few times, and I'm a big fan. One trick with the paper maps that I found that I just absolutely love. I can't. It was a guy at one of the local guys that I play with here. I saw him use it for the first time, and it's at Home Depot. You can buy these sheets of acrylic, I think it's like I don't remember the exact size. There's two sizes, but and I kind of wish I had the bigger one. I might buy another one. But it's a big sheet of acrylic for like shower walls and stuff.
Right.
And it sits right on top of any of the flat maps. And there's something about the way it feels underneath a mini. Like when you place a mini on it, it feels so solid. And the map doesn't move. There's no corners. There's no like little bump, little hill where the fold is.
And
because everything is perfectly smooth, it just feels better. So I've used like a poster map and then put that on top and then put Dwarven Forge on top of that. And it really creates this nice, multi-level, multi-layered, beautiful game map. So it's like $12 I think for this acrylic sheet, and it's totally worth it. I love it.
Well, and I think that's what some of the like the Sultan has built into the table.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
This
is the $12 way to turn your
no. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. No, I 100%. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic way to treat your paper maps, because again, you don't have. I've had to deal particularly with the Paizo maps. They even after you've had them flat for a long time, you still got that little ridge.
Right.
Or it goes over, and I have my game table is actually two of those what I call dining dining tables, the kind of tables you find in the church basement, you know?
Yeah, right.
I don't know, the folding tables, right?
Sure.
Yeah. But they're the big six, they're big 8-footers.
Yeah.
And I've got two of those pushed together. And so you have this like divot in the middle that's like an inch wide. And so I try to keep my map so that it's like jointed there at the divot.
Yeah.
But it, that plastic sheet would like go over that. That would be a good way to to do that if
yeah,
you've got.
It's a nice way to you know. Yeah, and I'm just looking on. I'm looking on the Home Depot site now, and it's like $20 for a 36x30-inch sheet. 36x48 is 30, but I think it's worth that. I think that's the one I'm going to pick up because it's a it'll fit over two maps, I think. So really nice and really lightweight. It's like you couldn't really travel with it, you know. I mean, you could if you're like in your car, you know, so you can throw it in the car. I guess it's no bigger than a poster. It's durable. So what other, do you have any other, I mean, you know,
well, I was going to ask, I had a question for you.
Yeah, sure.
And that's, what do you see, what things would you like to see in the future of 3D terrain?
Oh, wow.
What would you like to see?
Nothing, if
you,
because I don't want to buy anymore.
That's the cop-out answer.
So the trick with Dwarven Forge that I found, I love Dwarven Forge. It's very nice, but it's not perfect. And the stuff that I don't like about it is cost, obviously. It's very expensive. Yeah. And it's not even just, I mean, you know, look, I don't golf and I have no other hobbies but this. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, or all my other hobbies are like writing, which doesn't really cost anything.
Right.
So, you know, I don't feel bad about, you know, putting my, you know, resources into the thing that I enjoy. But the problem is once you're invested in it, you feel like you always have to use it.
Right.
You know, like if I've got three shelves worth of beautiful Dwarven Forge terrain, why on earth would I ever put down dungeon tiles?
Right.
You know, I should be using the stuff that's best.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually a little bit of a detriment because it's kind of an albatross. You always want to use it. You know, you right. always have it with you and you always want to use it. But the other thing is you need a lot of sets in order to really build a lot of unique stuff. You know, I always found that like I started with one set and I was like, oh, that's great. And I can build one room, but I really want to build like three. It'd be nice to build all, you know, a whole dungeon with one. So then you buy three and you're like, oh, wow. And next thing you know, you got the cavern set. Next thing you know, you got the, you know, Realm of the Ancient set and you need three of each of those. And then you're like, yeah, but it's the accessories that really make it. So you buy three accessory packs and now you got all that stuff. And next thing you know, you have, you know, 21 shelves worth of stuff, which is
yeah, and about, right now. And about $4,000 worth of Forge.
Yeah, I don't think I've paid $4,000. Thank God. But I've paid more than my first car.
Yo, know, I'm, wow. I'm yeah, there you go.
So, yeah, Mike, it was a cheap car. Yeah, I mean, I kind of joke. I mean, I always tell my, it was actually my wife who got me into it. She bought it for me for my birthday, and that started the downward spiral.
Mm-hmm.
She got me the tavern set, which I like a lot.
I will probably end up picking that up.
It's not bad, yeah. I like the tavern set. I don't find as many opportunities to use it because I don't have a lot of tavern fights.
Right.
But... you know, it's not bad. I mean, you can use it again. You can use it for a lot of things, but it's one of those where I think there's two different tavern sets and it really helps to have them both because you can build some really nice taverns with upper stages and, you know, stairwells and bars and in separate rooms and kitchens and stuff like that.
And it's uncanny how tavern basements almost always break into a dungeon. I don't know how.
Yeah,
that
right.
Is.
Well, yeah, actually.
But
yeah,
that's
exactly what's going to happen in my game next
week. Hey, there you go. Yeah, big, you spoiler know, alert.
Yeah, spoiler. Hopefully nobody will find out. So. God, so what do I want?
What would you like to see?
Terrain. I'd like more accessory stuff.
Yeah.
I'd like, you know, I don't have any fire pits. I really, and I saw some, but I think they came with a different set and it was too much money. Mm-hmm. But I really like the, they're called Wicked Edition sets. And the Wicked Edition sets have a bunch of different things in them. And I like those, but I could use some fire. You know, the things I want the most in 3D terrain, and I've found some cheaps, like Mage Knight makes some, and I picked up a bunch of cheap ass discount Mage Knight accessory packs, and they have like, you know, weird pillars with strange Aztec-y guys.
I've got one of those. Those are cool.
Yeah,
actually,
so I bought a bunch of those, sets, and they have a bunch of pillars with like weird things growing up them, and pillars with faces on them, and pillars with, you know, runes. Yeah. There's these two that are like these black obelisks with runes on them, and I must use those everywhere. It's like, and I use them because, again, they getting back to the first part of the conversation, they are clearer terrain effects, you know.
Right.
It's if I put an obelisk with a bunch of runes on it, you know, it does something,
right?
My the big joke in my campaign is, oh my god, don't go near the pillars. You know, whatever you do, don't go adjacent to a pillar because it's probably full of blades or scorpions.
Right. There's so, something's gonna happen. Yeah, something lightning gonna shoot happen out of that or right. whatever.
Yeah. Who knows what'll happen a pillar, but pillars are never good. So I mean, if I could, you know, if what I would love to see, you know, the Dwarven Forge people. I mean, I'm a total addict for Dwarven Forge, but I'd pick up other stuff if it was compatible. Is, you know, a set that's reasonably priced that's just loaded with little accessories, you know, just fire pits and altars and thrones and, you know, all different kinds of things that could have a direct effect in the game. It was nice that Wizards started to put some of that stuff out. They put out these little like crystal balls and little sarcophaguses. They have like these like metal sarcophaguses that I really like, sarcophagi.
Yeah, it was part of the miniatures line, right?
Yeah, it's part of the miniature stuff. They have little crossbow trap things. And I love those because they're little accessories. You can just kind of throw them in there and suddenly a room turns into a tomb because it's got four of these iron sarcophagi in it.
Well, that's one of the reasons there is one advantage there with the Hearst Arts is because he's got a number of those kinds of accessory molds.
Yeah, that's one of the things that got me kind of looking at it. I've got
eight sarcophagi that are Egyptian, and the sarcophagus lids actually open, and you can put a little mummy inside that you can cast the little mummy. And I've got these, and I must have everywhere there's a tomb, I've used these, even though it may not be an Egyptian-themed campaign, by God, these mummies are there.
That's great.
These sarcophagus. And it's just a fantastic little set piece that you just always have to use, you know. So,
I guess the other thing I'd like from 3D terrain, and then again, I'm just a Dwarven Forge guy, so when I think about it, that's what I think about. And what I would like is that pretty much every one of their sets that they come out with should be compatible with the other sets. So it should look the same. It should at least have pieces that bleed from one to the other. Mm-hmm. Not all of them do. Most of them fit together pretty well. I mean, you can go from the Cavernous Caverns, which is an awesome set, directly into the Room and Passage, and then you could have another room that's more of an ornate, you know, Realm of the Ancient kind of place. But I'd love more accessories that clearly just went with the Room and Passage set. You know, I think they have enough different varieties that they should make more that fit under the current ones, and that would get me to buy more. Because right now, I keep saying like I'm done. I've got enough. I don't ever need it. I've got enough to build anything in my mind that I want to build. And if it doesn't fit in these, I've got, you know, three boxes of dungeon tiles. And if it doesn't fit in those, I can, you know, use one of my maps. So I got plenty of options. Mm-hmm. So what I don't need is more stuff.
Well, I think, I have one, and it's a minor issue with Dwarven Forge, and that's that I wish their pieces fit together a little closer.
Yeah, sometimes.
I know there's supposed to be like a handcrafted feel to that, and I get that, and that's cool. Yeah. And it looks beautiful. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean.
The perfectionist in me wants to be able to join that stuff seamlessly.
Seam to seam, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it misses out a little bit on a few of their pieces. Yeah. But I think if I had my wish, I would find – I want someone to be the Lego of terrain. Not necessarily that snaps together, but in other words, an inexpensive plastic that looks okay, but you can get a lot of pieces in a set for a fairly low amount of money, and it's solid. It may not be as beautiful as Dwarven Forge or as handcrafted or whatever, but it would be quick and easy. But it would still be 3D terrain that would enhance the experience. Yep. I would love someone to fill that gap. And as I've looked all over, and there is no one that fills that gap. So I think it's a big opportunity for somebody out there to do that. The other thing is that, and this is actually towards the miniature end of it, because what do you put on 3D terrain? You put miniatures on 3D terrain. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to the guys at Litgo? Yeah, Litgo about this. I haven't heard back from them. But what I want is now that Wizards is like sold on their counters or whatever, or their little discs. That's great. I'll use a disc, but you know what? Let me hold that disc up vertically.
Yeah.
Let me slide it into a coin slot like a device that sits on the table like a miniature vertically. And it's opaque on one side so that you only see the side, you know, because if you flip them, you're bloodied. So you could slip that coin in and out. You know, flip it over if you're bloodied, but you move it about the table in a vertical position. I want that. Sure. That should not be hard to engineer. No. So if there's anyone out there listening to this,
make it. You sell a bag of 10.
Exactly. Right. You could sell a bag of 10 for $4.99.
Hasn't done that. That doesn't exist somewhere.
No, their Litco does have upright miniature stands for paper miniatures. So you could slide a little, you know, the
not
thin
for
cutout.
Thicker cardboard ones.
Right. So, but not the thick cardboards like, for example, you know, that Wizards uses. So someone get on that because that would be that would be great. And it would solve the miniature problem. I would not care in the world that Wizards didn't make any more plastic miniatures as much as I love them. I wouldn't care if I could hold those tokens upright so I could, they'd be seen and easy to move around.
Right.
It's like done deal. You know, so let's those are the two things in miniature. I mean, in 3D gaming technology that I'd really like to see. So,
yeah. Well, this has been a good conversation. I think we covered a lot of ground on on how to you know use terrain actually in your game mechanically, and also good places to get traps. So, appreciate you spending the time.
Oh, I appreciate it, Mike.
Yeah, we'll
good
do it
stuff.
Again.
All right.